Well, my name's Oliver Markley, and I am Professor Emeritus, as they say, retired from University of Houston, Clear Lake. My background is that I was educated as a design engineer, and with a four-year graduate fellowship at Stanford, I met Willis Harmon, the name some people you know. And he introduced me to humanistic psychology, and I decided I would rather like to be a humanistic social engineer. So I switched from engineering to social psychology. And just as I was getting my doctorate, it was 1968, the U.S. Office of Education was sponsoring a new kind of research called futures research. Look out 33 years to the year 2000, drawback implications for education that are proactive rather than reactive. And I thought, that's really neat. I'd like to do that. And Willis Harmon, by that time, had moved to Stanford Research Institute, hired me, and I spent the next 10 years there before getting recruited to come to Houston to chair the new, then 4 years old, graduate program in Studies of the Future out at Clear Lake, next to the NASA Johnson Space Center. 23 years there, then retired, and have been having no days off since that time. And the last 3 or 4 years, I basically said I've really got to come out of retirement and start publishing again, given the threats and the possibility of mega crisis and that. So that kind of is a back wrap to what I'll be talking about today. I'm really delighted and humbled to be once again in front of you all. I really do miss teaching. So before introducing the agenda, I really need to talk a little about this thing called mental time travel. Cindy spoke about the need for imagery and intuition as opposed to rationality. It turns out that when I went to SRI in 1968 and we started doing research on long-range alternative future histories, not just cross-sectional scenarios, but real future histories, out of some 50 highly plausible future histories out of 200 that we looked at impossible, almost all of them that were in any way desirable involved either incredible good luck or transformation as regards underlying values, policies about population growth, the pollution, resource depletion. As the one whose charge was methodology development, I reasoned that if transformation is a keynote to desirable futures, then almost by definition, rational analytic modes of thinking taken by themselves are not adequate, that we need to figure out how to get to intuition about being able to visualize, like the prophetic ones through the histories have been able to do, to get whole, transformed futures, see them whole, experience them, and like that. So the question then is how to best to tap intuition, and after investigating that, I realized that the best way to tap intuition would be guided cognitive imagery. So started to do that and created a Friday afternoon laboratory we called the Skunk Works that met off campus, and we'd basically, after having light refreshments, talk about the most difficult problems we were facing, trying to look at the long-range futures. And then I, with the idea that the guide should be guided, I would go in and intuitively visualize a new process to do that, and we'd do that. For example, when we were looking at air pollution, one time we visualized all climbing into a 10-foot diameter eyeball. That was our space-time ship that we then flew over the Los Angeles basin in the year 2020, looking around to see how much pollution, how much traffic, and like that. And we would share what we would each see with the idea that nobody is seeing the perfect thing, but when you average what the different people are seeing, that's a pretty good shot. Then we would translate that into the rational tools in the rest of the week and not write about the fact that we did in our methodology reports to clients. And in fact, it is only the most recent journal article called Imaginal Visioning for Prophetic Foresight that you'll find in the Journal of Future Studies, which I've really come out of the closet and talked about all of that in terms of what we need, and I recommend that article to you. So one of the best tools out of this is something called mental time travel, which is a method for intuitive remote viewing images of plausible alternate futures, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. But the key thing is that you experience, you see and feel what it is like to live in each of those different scenarios, and that's what we'll do at the end a little bit today. And one of the reasons that I'm putting this up ahead of the agenda is that, as a story I'll tell in a little bit, I think I've got more stuff in the agenda that we can really comfortably do, so I'm going to whip through these kind of things first so we can do the experiential things more leisurely at the end. So mental time travel can be done. If you read the journal article that's here, and I have a copy of it, it describes how you can not only do the mental time travel as yourself, but you can pretend to be another person, like a competitor. You can do it as impacts on our team, our employer, our country, the whole world, whatever. It's a really very flexible kind of thing. Now, to get to the story of why I'm putting this up front before the agenda, it turns out that Jerry Glenn, who's a CEO of the Millennium Project and has this handbook of futures research methods, in that he describes my approach to imaginal visioning and that, saying, well, there's one weakness, and that is that this mental time travel thing doesn't tell you which policies to look at the impacts of, or which scenarios to look at the impact of. And he thought that was a weakness. I thought that was a strength, because you can do it for whatever you want. But when Cindy invited me to do something about imagery in the future, my first thought was about, well, we ought to do some of this. Second thought was, ought to find some found art images of the future using that great research assistant called Google. And by God, I found some really good ones, and we'll see them in a bit. But taking Jerry Glenn's critique, it occurred to me that I really ought to then also look at the whole ideas of archetypes for visioning and scenario archetypes and other kinds of things. And then came up the idea of panarchy and the cycle of adaptation as a key driver for scenario selection. And and with that, I need to tell you a little story then about the use of mental time travel to really make my point about why I'm doing this up front part. In our little Friday afternoon Skunk Works, one of the main projects that I remember doing was a scenario project for the Department of Transportation, in which we were basically doing 9 alternate future histories. And so in the Friday afternoon Skunk Works, we would get visions to pack into the scenarios. When we got all done, we decided, hey, it would be really, they're getting ready to brief the client. Wouldn't it be good to live through each of the alternate future scenarios, the future histories, to really have it together? And it turns out that the project leader was not one of our futurist gang. It was a hard-bitten transportation engineer who was loaned to our group to keep these futurist guys straight, to make sure they weren't going to embarrass SRI to the Department of Transportation. So he very patiently went along with these Friday afternoon things. At the end of when we lived through all the scenarios, he says, damn, I've never had squat happen to me about this visioning stuff, but now I've lived through these scenarios, and for the first time, I feel really confident to brief them to the client because they're in my memory, they're in my gut. So I can really do that. So it turns out we had a half an hour left before the end of the day. I said, well, why don't we use the mental time travel to live through the briefing? So we started to do that. And in the middle of that little exercise, the same transportation engineer leaped up off the floor where he was laying with the rest of us to relax and be able to do the visioning. He said, oh, we can't do it that way. And he started to proceed to tell why what was planned wouldn't work. Redesigned the briefing on the spot. We went back, lived through it again, and saw, yeah, that'll work. And indeed, it did work perfectly. So my reason for telling the story is twofold. One is to give you a sense of how mental time travel can be used for very practical purposes. And the second is to say that by the time I did the whole agenda here, I realized I was not going to have time for the whole thing. And I had a conversation about that time with Andy about my early days of teaching futures, and how Peter Bishop and some others had to help me learn how to teach, because the futures research stuff I was trying to do just didn't work. And after about 3 semesters, when it finally worked, looking back, I realized that what I had done, that I had traded off trying to be technically comprehensive for being relational with the students and the material. So what we're going to do today is to be more relational, and we're going to whip through some of these. You know the difference between a briefing and training. Briefing is where you show all the slides, but don't do the detail. Training is where you do the details. So this will, I hope, be a relational briefing.
Yeah, so now it's safe. Whenever you organize a conference, you always tell presenters to stick exactly to the schedule, right? Because you don't want to tell them there's wiggle room. But now that we're here, there's a little wiggle room. Don't feel too overly, we have a fluid agenda in the afternoon, so we
okay.
go over a little bit.
Okay.
We're not worried about it, okay? So
okay,
if it's going well, we're not going to stop.
Cool.
Right.
And if there are any questions for clarification, don't hesitate to ask.
That's really tough there. That means you've got a hook somewhere. If it's going badly.
Gone.
Right, gone.
I know, right?
Okay.
That's Peter's job.
Wow, some things never end, huh, Peter? Okay, fine deal. So, first, add a bit of history, and Andy, if you want to warm up the thing.
We're ready.
How many people, by the way, know about Saul Bass's Why Man Creates? How many have seen it? Okay, how many have seen it more than once? I've probably seen it half a dozen times. Okay, so anyway, this is as good a way as any way that I could think of introducing our main topic for today. The soundtrack of the movie is not part of this recording. To see the movie, check the hyperlink that is carried in the PowerPoint visuals for this presentation. Okay, so, this was 1960, Academy Award winning short. What type of help is needed? Obviously, it's got to be alternate futures research, right? And here are three archetypal future possibilities that we will get back to later, but just kind of get a sense of them. And with that, then, we'll move to another found art footage by Christopher Barnett, whose work I think is very interesting. And you go ahead and click on that one. All right, so I chose this because it was about the future of cities, but I also chose it, there we go, okay. One of the perpetual topics in the seminar, pro-seminar course, is how as a futurist, new futurist, do you get your stuff out? And I was just really impressed by this guy's website and all the stuff he's doing to get his work out. So I thought of just putting this up as a kind of a benchmark, possible best practice for people to consider. Just take a look and see what you have. And the same thing is true from the next guy. Like, how many know about Alex Steffen's work in World Changing? Really good stuff. So here's a video about him, and then we'll also see his website. Go ahead.
Yeah, just a quick comment. Just in how this stuff works, about 6 years ago, we did a project for a big agriculture company looking at future business opportunities. You know, the first round, you kind of have the speculative ones, and then we were going to get down to the priority ones. And we brought up vertical farming. And for a group of experts, they just looked at that. They gave us that, like, uh-oh, should we have really hired these guys? It didn't make the cut. And, you know, it was really a rough concept back then, mm-hmm. but, you know, here we are 6 years mm-hmm. later, and there's a really nice, you know.
Andy, you were right. There's a restaurant, my office is right next to a restaurant called Backstreet. They buy their lettuce from a guy that has taken a cargo, one of those metal cargo things,
yeah.
turned it into a hydroponic, and it's just, well, I'll say right down the road, but... Like 5 miles from the restaurant, and they go there on a daily basis and get their lettuce and serve it fresh every day, and it hasn't sat in a...
Interesting.
Cool.
So you were ahead of their time, and they missed their boat.
Moving ahead.
We'd like to think so, right?
So Alex Steffen on Shareable Future of Cities. Okay, so that was Alex Steffen. And here is his most recent book, World Changing 2.0. How many people have seen this? Comments on it very briefly?
It's very accessible. And when I heard him speak at the Design Futures Council in Portland earlier,
actually ended last year.
Mm-hmm.
He still got the same talk, but what's interesting about this is that he's getting now into a much more accessible
yes.
component rather than having
and things that people are doing and can do. I had the first book. I've not seen a second one. When I was preparing this, I saw it. I went to his website, saw this. Oh, I've got to get this. But I'll tell you, really, if you like the video you just saw, this one is 17 minutes, which is longer than I can pack in here, but it's a higher, much higher quality in terms of substantive content ideas about cities of the future, and I recommend it highly. And again, his website, and like that, I think is a real benchmark best practice that you might take a look at. So with that, then, that's about the found art images. That's the first component. Now we start moving toward archetypes for visioning. And you're all familiar with the cone as you move out from the future, like preferable, probable, plausible, wild cards at the outside of here. And so the idea then that I wanted to introduce to you, it was a new idea to me about 6 months ago, is the idea of scenario archetypes that originated with Jim Dator, who's the creator of the University of Hawaii program and head of their Research Center for Future Studies. Clem Beazle then, of the Institute of Alternative Futures, picked up Dator's ideas and hitched him into his aspirational futures methodology, which, by the way, I finally decided is the one best practice in which to embed guided imagery and future time travel kinds of things. I think it is the best single one-size-fits-all methodology that there is out there. So Dator's scenario archetypes, he started out with 9 or 10, ending up with 4, continued growth, collapse. Conserver society is basically attempts to make things sustainable, but within the given value set. Transformational society is a realization you really need to transform values in order to achieve sustainability. And so Beazle then, in his aspirational futures methodology, put these back into these four, the expected present trends extended as one archetype, a challenging, fearful, worst case, but usually it's not worst case for an ordinary, worst case gets you into wild card territory, aspirational, the hopeful, and the audaciously aspirational, the visionary, and there he tapped into Jim Collins' work about how to really create corporations that really excel, and the whole thing then what they call a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal. So there's that. And then I like the idea of wildcard archetypes, and you probably have heard talk about my piece about the type 2 wildcards, the ordinary wild, type 1 wildcard, low probability, but high impact if it were to occur. Type 2 is something that particular experts see has high probability, but has low credibility for things overall. And when I was at SRI, one of the last projects I did was about what we then called the carbon dioxide effect, greenhouse, global warming. And it turns out it was just before the National Academy of Sciences was ready to publish their big book called Energy and Climate, so we were able to get a hold of all the studies. And so what we did was we, using a systems approach, looked at all the variables that were being used in the climate circulation computer models, but also the variables that ecologists knew about that weren't used in that, and we put together a flowchart of all of those. Most of the ones that were not being simulated were positive feedback loops, right? Deviation amplification, from which we simply reasoned, aha, in principle, they're going to be underestimating the impacts of global warming. And we also then, looking at systems kind of approach, realized that the first impacts that we'd be seeing is about how rapidly things are changing. Climate change will be seen before the global warming effect. So tried to get that stuff published in the climatology literature. They wouldn't pay attention to what. So I ended up publishing it in Journal of Technology Forecasting and Social Change.
What year was that?
That was the study was done in 76. The TF, the technology forecasting piece, was one of the first things I did when I went to Clear Lake. That was like 82. And then when I was, I lectured about type 2 wildcards. But given the kind of problems we're you're going to see next, we're going to talk about, a couple of years ago, I realized it's time to publish about type 2 wildcards. So then I went back and looked, and sure enough, there's verification of all of those. So then it's like smoking gun evidence that this was, in fact, a valid type 2 wildcard. And it is, in that sense, about prediction. But it's if-then prediction. It's if current trends continue, then here's what's likely to happen. So with that then, the main type 2 wild card that I want to put in terms of a scenario driver, how many here are already familiar with panarchy theory and the cycle of adaptation? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? Good? Okay. Not going to be able to get into detail about it, but it's absolutely critical. The cycle of adaptation is a three-dimensional model having to do with capacity, connectedness, and resilience, and resilience is the key thing. And a way to think about this, now this is another imagistic look at the future. Basically, here we start out at the beginning of things, all, you know, only the Indians out there, and white man comes and gradually start building. Here's the railroad, and then things get built up and on down until finally things really get built out here, and then we here we are at the same three alternative futures we saw before. The one about, hey, gee whiz, everything builds out, or we could have collapse, or we could have an ecotopia kind of solution here. And but where this plays into panarchy theory is that it's about, and this panarchy theory applies to all levels of self-organizing systems, whether microbes, cells, organisms, ecological niches, organizations, and like that. It is about starting out when things are open and you can get kind of open-ended for growth. There's lots of resilience, not too much connectedness until finally you get down here where things are very connected and the system is much more fragile to disruption. Here's a little bit more a little more detail about that, and here's about how these things will trigger, so you can have concatenating trigger points leading to a tipping point toward disruption. And a way to really get into that is a book by Thomas Homer Dixon, The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. And the best short take on the panarchy theory I know is in World Watch. This Homer Dixon has this piece, Our Panarchic Future. I have one caveat about the book. It turns out that his major graphic that shows the cycle of adaptation, he has his own version of it. It turns out he's got the resilience vector labeled in the wrong direction. It's totally amazing. I don't know how it slipped through, but anyway, there it is. So what does this lead to then is the idea of mega crisis that may be headed ahead. And so here's how things keep getting tighter and tighter, and there can be a concatenation of triggering events so that there could be a tipping point toward things really kind of going south on us. And then the question is, how far will it go and it will come out and like that. And with that, the main point that I want to make is I think it is absolutely critical for futures research in our era to move beyond cross-sectional, two by two, four-fold cross-sectional scenarios and into if-then contingent alternate future histories. And a way to think about that, then, there are these four archetypal scenarios, plus a pleasant tens, VUCA, the world of rapidly increasing volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. This is the present trends extended archetypal future. Civilizational disintegration, a challenging or worst case. Reformative civilizational recovery, the aspirational or visionary future. Enlightenment, an audaciously visionary, our best case future. And then there's, of course, Kurzweil's singularity, which is an alternative, audaciously visionary, aspirational future. And with that, I'd like you to go to the handout, not about the PowerPoint, but the background reading on the bottom of, on page 2. It says note. And this note, for me, is almost the most important part of the whole thing. scenario one, VUCA, if it holds together until 2030, then the singularity, scenario five, as revisioned by Ray Kurzweil, could emerge. Otherwise, I think it's dead in the water. If there's downturn, how could it happen?
But can I just ask you a quick question of the students here? What would we call scenario one? What's it in our terminology?
Baseline.
The baseline, right? That's we use the word.
Right. Okay.
Baseline.
The difference, though, here is that the baseline is one of rapidly increasing VUCA, which means the baseline is complexity, hairiness.
Yeah.
And that word is really getting out there. People are really starting to get that. So that's something that futurism can really take credit for. Is done.
Yep.
It is a new day in that regard. So, second bullet. So if scenario one, VUCA, on the other hand, triggers a mega crisis tipping point towards civilizational disruption, this could lead to the worst case of scenario two, civilizational disintegration, or the best case of scenario three, reformative civilizational recovery, or to scenario four, civilizational enlightenment. So the importance of seeing these if-then contingencies as a way to doing contingent strategic planning. And again, to go back to the mental time travel piece, the reason we did it was a way to do intuitive impact assessment. So you assume if this, now let's get in and let's do the mental travel to see what it could lead to. If this, let's see what it could lead to. And then when you've looked at all of them, you say, what are the common elements to all these if-thens for the good news and the bad news? What are the things that strategies would work in any of these, in all of them, and what are the things that are bad news that are common to all of them? Then those are the things we absolutely need to invest in. Scenario four, civilizational enlightenment, could presumably unfold at any time, but is thought to be likely only after something like scenario three, the reformative civilizational recovery, matures. Okay. And the main thing that I'm looking at doing, I'm interested in talking to some of these justice guys here in the back of the room, is that as part of my environmental scanning about all of these things, I mean, there's a lot of stuff about how the police forces are getting armed with military-grade weaponry, and the CIA is teaching them how to do what the Israelis did with the Palestinians about defining responsible activists as citizen terrorists, indefinite detention, and all the rest. We really need to be publishing something for the Justice Department, because if we don't have opportunity for citizen activists to plant seeds for the recovery, and when the downturn occurs, economic meltdown, people rioting, and wholesale detention, how do the justice people be able to discriminate between responsible activists and the rest? That's something we need a responsible future is to be doing proactive stuff on now, it seems to me. Okay, so that's about that. And these scenarios then are archetypal scenarios, pretty much on the wild card edge, the type 2 wild card edge that experts say, yeah, this is likely. But for practical purposes, here is probably the most reasonable baseline set of alternatives. You all know about the National Intelligence Council? This is also a website that I highly recommend you go to for, I think, the most credible set of alternative futures that are out there right now. So there are those, and we could use those as well, but we're going to have six. Oh, dear. So I see that I still have 6 minutes, and we have the visioning to go. It did take longer than I anticipated. So. Here's the way you generally do alternate future scenario kind of work. And so to start getting into that, you can go ahead and dim the lights, and we'll start getting into the experiential kinds of things. So I'd like you to kind of sit with your feet on the floor and just relax. Take a moment and go inside and just get with your feelings as a result of all the things you've seen and heard this morning. Some of them are kind of upsetting. Some of them are reinforcing. And just kind of let go of everything in order to be aware of what comes next. And then just recall the progression that we saw in that first little movie clip, The Edifice. And recall the hunter-gatherer tribesmen who cooperated in killing the beast. Just imagine that you could be there with them. We'll actually do it, but just get a sense of what it would be like to be able to, using mental time travel or something, to really be there. And then just recall the planting of crops leading to settlements and early cities, and the progression through time, the invention of mathematics, the Dark Ages, onto the multiple ages of technology, the invention of dynamite, the telegraph, onward through the industrial era, leading to the heap of airplanes, the radioactive cloud, and the voice calling, "Help!" which is a call to us. Similarly, take a moment to visualize a history of America that Robert Crumb depicted, leading from rural beginnings through towns to cities, and finally to three different visions of the future, which is where we'll really start with our little exercise here. So I'd like you to visualize and feel into each of the three alternate futures, imagining what you would see and feel if we had time to fully explore the details of each, using a process much like mental time travel, but just right now, just imagine that you were in the future of continued material growth to gee whiz future mechanization and cities that are based on that kind of gee whiz future. What does it feel like to be in that future? Just kind of look around in your imagination, get a sense of what cities are like in this future. And in this future, what is most needed to make city life better? If you were there and you were a futurist, what might you be saying? Hey, here's what's needed. What might that be? Okay, and then let that one go and just kind of clear your inner deck. And imagine that you're moving into a future of civilizational collapse, where the word civilization originally meant cities. And things, there's been economic meltdown, and governance failures, the infrastructure that was pointed out is necessary for cities to work effectively is kind of coming apart. Just be in that future. See what it feels like. Don't get too deeply into the feelings, but just get a sense of them. And again, get a sense of, if you were a futurist in this scenario, what might you be saying? What are the particular needs for futurists if there is civilizational collapse? Good. Then let go of that one. Again, clear the decks internally. Move toward the green revolution to an ecotopia future. Very different. Maybe getting a sense of the kind of things that would have led up to that, but imagine that's happened and we're well into that. See how that feels. See what things are present here and what things are missing. Are there cities here? What are they like if they are? Just get a sense of all the different kinds of things you could explore if we had time to fully get into this whole future. And then let go of that and again clear the decks for action. So that's an exploration of three different alternative futures, and now I'd like you to imagine moving into the actual future as it is going to unfold. So as a way to do that, imagine that you're leaving here at the end of this gathering. We've had a good time today, and we're going to play tonight. And then tomorrow, you're probably going back to your residence. And next week, your place of work. When you're back at your residence, if you were to reflect on the things you experienced and learned here with us together, what is the one or the several main things that stand out for you now as you look back on our time together? What did you find most valuable? And imagine now that you jump ahead 3 years to the year 2015. The VUCA, or baseline trajectory of increasing societal volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity, has greatly intensified. Several major disruptive events triggering steeply systemic change have happened. So just take a few moments and feel into this scenario and see what you intuit as being the most likely triggering events that have by now occurred. Whatever it is that you saw, visualize how they have impacted on society and on cities. Good. Now, before we go on, just imagine that you're able to speak into a recorder to tell the main things that you saw and felt just now. What would be the main things you'd like to record, just to transfer them into long-term memory? Good. Now let the arrow of scenario time continue, and as you move into the future toward the year 2020, it's as if a major wild card popped up, suddenly forcing you into a right-angle turn from the VUCA trajectory you were on into a totally different scenario. Just take a deep breath right now, and as you let it out, let your intuition inform you about the specific alternative wild card future that is most important for you to experience at this time. Take the breath, and as you let it out, let it happen right now. Don't think about what it should be, just let it emerge. What do you notice first? And what else do you notice? If you had time to fully explore this wild card future, what specific things do you think you'd like to look into and understand better? What about this specific future alternative would have an impact on the future of cities that would be different from other future possibilities that we've considered? Okay, then clear the decks on that one, and imagine again that you were speaking into a recorder. What are the things that you would say to yourself that you really wanted to remember from what you saw here in this wild card future? good. And now there's much more we could look at here, and we could also look at 2030, another kind of a pivotal year that's talked about by Kurzweil and that. But given the time we have available, I'd like you to look way ahead, 100 years or four generations into the future. If you have offspring or you will have offspring, this would be the time when your grandchildren's grandchildren are alive. Be there now, 100 years in the future. What type of world are they inheriting from us and from those who come after us? What is it like? What do you feel? What do you see? What do you notice first? What else? And what are cities like here? Do they have cities? Are they the same, different? How are the cities here? So if you were a citizen here 100 years from now and could send a message back to the year 2013 as to what they most need from us, what would that message be? Again, take a few moments to imagine recording the main things you saw in this part of the exercise so you can remember them later. And then come back. I'll wait until everybody's opened their eyes. Okay, what we did was not really mental time travel that involves getting into a deeply relaxed altered state, and I taught a whole class in visionary futures where you learn to do it, but this was like a taste, and it was an example of what you can do with audiences without getting into the altered state. At this point, I would usually like to have people pair up and share what they experienced. We don't have time for that, I don't think. I'm going to turn it back to Andy to have discussion now or move on to the next presentation as you might like to.
Why don't we have a little, Q&A, and I'm going to squeeze another chair in if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your patience.
All right.
So we do have some time for questions or observations or comments, so we're not that pressed. So Emily, yes.
Oliver, I actually have a question for you. So when you're doing this mental time travel, do you typically do it with futurists? Have you done it with non-futurists, more analytical type people? So if you're doing with non-futurists, do you need to build a certain level of insight before you go into this?
What you certainly need to do is build in a level of acceptance, because the idea of doing visioning in that is not credible for all audiences. In fact, we did this thing, a group from General Motors and EDS were down wanting to learn how to do futures, and we had a real problem. In the morning, we were talking about world strategies and whether GM should have a strategy for the developing nations and all. So we all did a mental time travel, and they, by and large, were not futurists, but they because they were interested in learning how to do it, they were open to it, and so we moved ahead. It's absolutely critical to get acceptance of the method so that the thing can move forward. Once you have that, then it's depending on how expert they are, what their background, it's an expert facilitation to weave things together so that it will work. So expert facilitation is really key.
Can I add to that?
Sure.
I don't do these for other people, but I do appreciate what he's doing. And I used to do a lot of presentations with someone that did this quite a bit. And amazingly, the very rational people, like the FBI was one we spoke to, loved it. It was amazing. It didn't have to do with that. It had to do with their, maybe their interest in explorations. You know, and so those FBI guys were very curious people. That's what they do. And so even though they're terribly analytical, mm-hmm. they wanted to know how to think into other people's minds. You know, they really, really did enjoy it.
So I would suggest that the suspension of disbelief is fundamental to human understanding. It's something that we look for in spirituality, in the movies. You know, when we talk to our friends and brag about things, it's a big deal, and that's key to this, any kind of facilitation.
Joe Coates helped me with this. He does this kind of work, by the way, guided imagery and that. It's just put it in terms that people understand and are open to.
Yeah.
When I was in UT in the 70s, I studied hypnosis under Dr. Richard Hawkins, who was a certified hypnotist. And hypnotism is an altered state of consciousness. It's the relaxed state where you're then open to the power of suggestion. And all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. However, you think, well, but what's the hypnotist? The hypnotist is the guide. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely analogous to everything we did here just now and to everything that you're saying. And I thought it was funny, Cindy brought up the FBI. The books we used on hypnosis back in the 70s, all the really good stuff, was written by FBI agents. And that's why they are open to this, because it's whatever you want to call it, you know, yoga, meditation, mm-hmm. you know, futuring. It's, right. If you put yourself in a relaxed state, you are open to subject.
Actually, now that you mentioned hypnosis, I will say that the whole thing of relaxation, which is a way of relaxing the inhibitions that the egoic mind has to intuition, which contains things that the ego doesn't want to see. By relaxing, you relax an inhibition and it relaxes the filter so that the other kinds of things can come out. And in fact, scenarios can be seen as a type of hypnosis through which people can experience alternate aspects of reality that they otherwise would not be open to, and as a way to sell ideas whose time has not come, experientially. Yeah.
Jason?
Yeah, Oliver, we went through a very similar process with a group of educators, mm-hmm. and to great success.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that, though, was, you know, we kind of brought them to the door and said, okay, you want to do visioning, we have this method. So they didn't really have any other choice but to dive right into the imaginal time travel. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of like, you know, your lack of a choice led you here, but great success. And I really didn't know which way it was going to go. It helped that we had, you know, a solid artifact for them to pin it on.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
Most of the people in our group had just had children.
Mm-hmm.
So when we started to think of, okay, let's imagine building this school for your children, mm-hmm. that, you know, you just had them, mm-hmm. you're going to go home and see your baby tonight, and then mm-hmm. let's take it a step farther and build it for their children. Mm-hmm. So it helped to have that artifact that they were emotionally tied to, mm-hmm. in a very strong way.
Right.
But
yeah, comment on that, by the way. Mental time travel does not work if you're not doing it about something you don't care about.
Yeah.
The emotional aspect of this and the feelings is absolutely critical. And in terms of full transparency, where the mental time travel piece came from is a very far out esoteric book called Seth Speaks, mm-hmm. by Jane Roberts. There's a chapter called Alternative Presence, meaning the plural of present, like scenarios, and multiple focus. And when my research assistant, Ruth Miller, gave that to me at SRI years and years ago, I picked it up, and the book literally fell open to the page where, in very cryptic terms, this thing was described, and bang, I got downloaded with the whole idea about mental time travel in a flash. Something that Robert Monroe, who started the Monroe Institute, calls getting a rote. where a whole bunch of stuff comes in. It's one of the ways in which transcendental information sometimes comes in. And so I simply then wrote up what I saw there. But if you want to go to the origin of that, go to Seth Speaks, and I have it referenced in the journal article.
So we can take one more question, okay. I think
I just had a comment. I think if you're going to use this in any kind of work, you have to believe it yourself.
You have to believe it yourself?
Yes, because I think if you don't or you're not comfortable with it yourself, that comes off first.
Well, even more than believing in it, it's kind of like the Kentucky sheriff who is running for re-election, and the Baptist minister says, so, he says, do you believe in baptism? He said, believe? Well, I've seen it done. Is you really have to have done it yourself and have a sense of that. And with that, as a facilitator, you learn a way of feeling the people you're with.
To pick up, to make a whole out of it.
Right.
Instead of two parts.
Right. And it's just a little brief caveat that came up when I was teaching in Visionary Futures course, where we got people down to level and we really kind of feel each other. He says, Dr. Markley, how's it is that you're getting ready to do the next instruction and I start having it happen to me before you say it? And as we pieced it out, it was when I thought of the next instruction, they're starting to experiencing it because that's when I was getting ready to say it, and they're linked in enough because, after all, we are all actually, in the further sense of it, all part of the extended one mind. So, with that, thank you.
All right. So, thank you very much. Round of applause. Welcome.